Vegetarianism is a way of life, life of vigorous thought, constructive activity of generous service, not a religion of inherited creeds, dead heroes, saints, or holy books. Unitarianism is not an easy religion. It demands that people think out their beliefs for themselves and then live up to those beliefs. The stress is placed upon living this life nobly and effectively rather than on the preparation for an afterlife experience. If you have given up religion or despaired of finding a faith that makes sense in the modern world, hear Monroe Husbands at the YMCA. That was an article in the Galveston Daily News on Sunday, November 11th, 1951, that the Orell family placed. On November 25th, 1951, 14 people gathered at the Orell's home to begin the work of organizing this fellowship. A little over a month later, the fellowship was officially recognized by the American Unitarian Association in January of 1952. This is known as the beginning of our fellowship. We celebrated our 50th anniversary in 2002. This fellowship was planted as part of the fellowship movement of the American Unitarian Association. In his 2002 UU World article, A Precarious Path, The Bold Experience of the Fellowship Movement, Warren Ross describes it. One morning in 1947, Lenore Stewart of Boulder, Colorado, became aware that her four-year-old son was going door-to-door asking his neighbors whether they would please take him to Sunday school. Dumbfounded, Stewart realized that he had taken her too literally. A Mormon by birth who no longer found the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints acceptable, she had explained to him that she did not believe the things he would be taught in Sunday school, so that if he wanted to go, he would have to find someone else to take him. Well, there he was, looking. Having heard of Unitarianism from a friend and determined to find a religious education program in line with her convictions, Stewart thought it might fit her needs. There was, however, no Unitarian church in Boulder, nor anywhere reasonably close. By coincidence, she spotted a notice in the local paper that the minister of the Unitarian Church in Denver would be lecturing at the State University, and she went up to him afterwards to ask his advice. "Well," he said, "you're just going to have to do it yourself," and told her where to write for Unitarian curriculum materials. That was the seed from which grew the first of the lay fellowships formed under a novel program launched by what was then the American Unitarian Association. Starting in 1948 and flourishing through the early 60s, this program attracted thousands of new members to hundreds of new fellowships, some of which are among our most vibrant congregations today. But while the do-it-yourself movement spread Unitarian congregations far and wide, estimates range from 400 to 600 new congregations, many remained much smaller than denominational leaders hoped, and many others failed after promising starts. While new fellowships continue to form today, Unitarian Universalist growth experts no longer regard the fellowship program as the ideal model for developing new congregations. But the fellowship movement gave the denomination far greater geographical reach and indelibly shifted its theological identity, its culture, and its worship practices. Looking back, the fellowships were a bold experiment in liberal religion, and new models of congregational growth continue to draw on their lessons. From the end of World War II through the years after the consolidation of the AUA and the Universalist Church of America in 1961, the fellowship program helped hundreds of small congregations get started using a surprisingly simple model. The first fellowship in Boulder was a sterling example. Lenore Stewart and a few other mothers started using the curriculum she received from the AUA to teach their kids in their own homes on Sunday mornings. As the group expanded, the parents decided to get together themselves on Sunday evening, and after they'd outgrown their homes, began to meet in real spaces such as the Congregational Church. As their numbers kept increasing, they looked for a permanent meeting place and eventually first rented and then bought a decrepit carriage house that they fixed up with their own labor. Eventually, the congregation called a minister and took on other characteristics of a church, and spawned a second fellowship. But that's jumping ahead and does not describe the course all fellowships followed. Unbeknownst to these bolder pioneers, so many young parents were searching for a liberal religious community that AUA leaders had started talking about ways to support them. In the 1940s, Unitarians were still heavily concentrated in the Northeast, especially in New England, where their tradition had its origins. Outside of a few scattered cities, anyone interested in Unitarianism in most of the rest of the country had to be content, as Thomas Jefferson put it, to be a Unitarian by myself. With the baby boom just getting underway, though many liberal parents, like the Stuarts, were searching for a religious home for themselves and their children, because many of them were moving to the suburbs that were sprouting outside of metropolitan areas, they often had no social or religious ties in their new communities. Thus, many of the new fellowships were formed in mushrooming suburbs. Having voted in 1945 to explore forming lay-led centers in communities with too few Unitarians to warrant a church, the AUA board in May 1948 launched the Lay Fellowship Plan suggested by the Reverend Lon Ray Call, the AUA's minister at large. His premise was that previous extension efforts lacked flexibility, so he suggested that each of these new units be permitted to, quote, choose its own leaders and evolve its own purposes, goals, methods of operation, mood, setting, philosophy, and emphasis. Sound familiar? Headquarters would help the groups get started with ideas, suggestions, and worship and religious education materials, but otherwise they should be left to work out their own destinies. Part of the rationale was that there were simply not enough ordained ministers to support a lot of new congregations, so that any meaningful program of growth would have to depend on lay leadership. The AUA appointed a layperson, Monroe Husbands, as director of the new program. Husbands was also the appointed clerk of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, or CLF, which the AUA organized in 1944 to serve isolated Unitarians through the mail. 2 years later, the Universalist Church of America formed a similar non-resident church. The two were united in 1961, and today, as of 2002, it served more than 3,000 members, and it's much larger now. Husbands would scan CLF's mailing list to see where there might be clusters of Unitarians, and when he spotted three or more, he wrote to ask whether they are aware of each other and encourage them to meet. If that worked, he would plan to visit and suggest they form a fellowship. By the time he came to Boulder, Lenore Stuart and her fellow pioneers had already established a core structure. With her husband, Omer C. Stuart, an anthropologist at the University of Colorado, serving as president. They liked what Husbands had to tell them about the new program, and on July 28, 1948, the Unitarian Fellowship of Boulder was officially recognized by the association as the first of its new lay-led congregations. Husbands was a modern version of the old Universalist circuit riders, according to the Reverend Dr. John C. Morgan, minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Berks County in Reading, Pennsylvania. Morgan served for 5 years in the late 1980s as a church growth consultant at UUA headquarters and spent many hours interviewing Husbands to learn from his experience. Husbands died in 1984. He said he would come into town, book a public site for a presentation, meet with people interested in forming a new group, provide them with the resources, and then keep going, Morgan says. He would try to stay in touch with them, but the denomination lacked the resources to help them keep going. As a result, while Husbands helped an astonishing number of fellowships get started, only about half survived for more than a few years. And we are one of them. This article goes on to explore the pros and cons of the movement for the long-term growth of the association, but that's another sermon. For today, it's important to know that this is our history and says a lot about who we are. So why should we care about our history, about the people and decisions that have kept UUFGC alive these 61 years? For me, the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants captures my feelings. I first heard this phrase when Reverend Annette Marquis used it to describe her feelings on a tour of historic places of the civil rights movement. It inspires her work as the LGBTQ and Multicultural Ministries Program Manager at the UUA. The best known use of this phrase was by Isaac Newton in a letter to his rival Robert Hooke in 1676. What Descartes did was a good step. You have added much several ways, and especially in taking the colors of thin plates into philosophical consideration. If I have seen a little further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Newton didn't originate it, though. The 12th century theologian and author John of Salisbury used a version of the phrase in a treatise on logic called Metalogicon, written in Latin in 1159. Translations of this difficult book are quite variable, but the gist of what Salisbury said is, "We are like dwarves sitting on the shoulders of giants. We see more and things that are more distant than they did, not because our sight is superior or because they are taller than they, or because we are taller than they, but because they raise us up and by their great stature add to ours." So who are we because of those who came before? And who will be after us? Who will stand on our shoulders? I think we have a little bit of time. So what I wanted to do is see if anyone is interested in sharing. First, inviting those who have been members more than 30 years. Is there anyone who would like to come up and tell a story of something you remember? You don't have to. Well, you don't have... Yeah, well, we want to hear. So the people who have been... Are you willing, Ellen?
I just think, can I just say how grateful I am? I'm talking about standing on people's shoulders. I'm just grateful for anything that came before, way back to early Unitarians. And I'm just grateful that this group is here. I feel like that's not very original, but I feel like I'm inspired. But anything that the whole history that coming down from whatever something like I will share with you. Well, by my father's bedside was Emerson's writings. So I don't get this it's in my blood to be a Unitarian, even though I went to Trinity because is this relevant to what you're doing?
Well, we just wanted to see if you're telling a story of something you remember from...
About this particular...
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess I'm trying to pull into this particular... Well, I've been in it for forever and ever, and I'm grateful. Mm-hmm. To, I mean, I was in the mob, which you've all heard about. You've all heard me say I was in the mob for whenever she's going to some people, and you figured it out. It didn't last, but it did. Hey, hooray!
Thanks, Ellie. I think Neil has something.
Thank you for letting me stay here.
Well, of course, there are people here that have been here longer than I have, but one story I like to relate is one Andy Baker used to talk about. Back when they were still forming, they met at the VFW here in Galveston. And Hale O'Rell used to talk about how to clean up the night after, you know, the big drinking and the partying and the vomit and all that, having to clean it up and trying to meet the next day and the tribulations. And they finally decided that we didn't belong because we weren't Christian, and they told us we'd have to leave. I sent Don Stubbs some photographs when he painted that picture that I had that were kind of blurry, but he managed to get a picture out of it. But one thing he did remove was those horrible power lines, those high-tension power lines that come right over the building, and he thankfully removed those from the painting.
Actually, it was the YWCA we got kicked out of, Neil, not the VFW. Well, we joined when we moved to Galveston. I was three or four, so like 1950, three or two or something. Anyway, I can remember being at the YWCA, and we would do a Christmas pageant with all the kids dressed up as angels, which was quite interesting. And we never had 50 children. That's a mistake. We might have had 50 members. Although I can remember at one time, I think we had 34 members, but we never had 50 children. But we had, there were four Baker kids, me and my sister and brothers, the Pepper kids, that was Nan and Jack. That's six. Oh, the Zinelden children came sometime. Zula Zinelden, I don't know if she's still a member, but she lives in Avia. And Ahmed, wasn't it Ahmed? Anyway, so I remember some of them. And then we went over to Lamarck. Oh, God, did I hate going to Lamarck. Because we lived on Tightman Road, but we had to go across the causeway. And Mama made us go kicking and screaming every Sunday, driving over to Lamarck. And I'm like, who goes to church in Lamarck? You know, I don't go over there now either. But anyway, we were in that building for quite some time. It was a nice little building, but we had portable buildings in the back. We had, I think there were three of them, and that was the Sunday school. And we did have a lot of kids. We never had 50, though. But we never had 20, I don't think. But we had buildings. In fact, when Pete and I were married, I think we were still in Lamarck Church, yeah, fellowship. But it was divided by age group back there. And at one point, everybody was like, you know, these buildings are so bad, I think this roof's going to cave in. And we were there when we hired a quarter-time minister. By that time, I guess we were adults. See, Pete and I got married in 69. I dragged him over there. And I got him to take the kids when I was in law school to church so I could study on Sunday mornings because I was working and driving into Houston to law school. And that's how he became a very devout Unitarian. So, but we owned that freeway property, and we wanted to build on it, but we never could build enough of a congregation to afford to build a nice building on that freeway property. And then the Bay Area church opened, and some of our members left, like the Higbees, who I dearly love. They live in Dickinson, and they left and went there, and it was easier for them to go to the Bay Area church. And so eventually we had a bunch of meetings, and Harry Levy was always real involved in this, but we talked about moving back to the island because of the UTMB folks would help us build the church up, the fellowship up. And but we had this freeway property, and what should we do with it? We didn't actually sell the freeway property. By then I was practicing law. And so we were going to sell the freeway property, but I can't remember the name of the man that claimed he owned it and that we didn't have good title to it. So we negotiated for quite some time, me and him, and he ended up making a donation, I think, of $35,000 that he could write off if we would convey the title, a free and clear title to him of that property. And then we turn around, we use that money eventually to buy the property across the street from Ball High, which we lost through eminent domain, but we got so much money from them we were able to buy this property. So it turned out to be a good thing. So we raised our children in this fellowship, and at one time they were the only kids, and now neither one of them raised their kids Unitarian. But and I always say I'm a Unitarian. I say I'm a UU. I've never been a Universalist. Anyway, so that's basically what I remember. Mom and Dad were pretty devout. My mother used to do the newsletter on a manual typewriter. And she had this old typewriter that came over with Columbus, and she'd sit at the kitchen table and pound out every week. Well, we lived across the street from the newspaper, so she would just either drive or walk over the newspaper and hand it in. But she did that, it seemed like, for years. I don't know if it was or not. And Daddy was on the board many times, and I can't remember if Mom was, but she was always doing that newsletter. Was she? Okay, that makes sense. And we used to have a big picnic every year and would have it out at our property, which is now Baker's Landing, that my brother, who just won the car, and I bought from our other siblings when Mom died a year and a half ago. But because it's on the water, we would have the big picnic there. And I kind of missed that. That was a lot of fun. And see what else I can remember. It was always good camaraderie. The quarter time guy didn't work out, just like Bill Murchison didn't work out, because we really don't want to pay a full-time person, but we want them to work full-time. So that's kind of been a problem. But those are the only two ministers I can remember ever being associated with us. But and Bill married John and I, and he married y'all too. He married Pete and Diane too. And that I do remember. So that's my recollections.
So we just have like time for like one more comment. Go ahead.
Actually, I've got a comment.
Okay, maybe two.
It's kind of a paradox, but I'll make it short. Although I didn't join until 2001, I guess you could say I kind of made a round trip, because way back when this fellowship was in Lamarck, my parents were members. And the thing I remember more than anything else, of all things, you know, that a 10-year-old kid would remember, was in this one of the Sunday school buildings. I remember seeing this map of the Earth, and it was a most unusual map because it showed Antarctica at the top and the North Pole at the bottom. And I remember it clear as day, and I remember asking the person who was, you know, who was watching over, for lack of a better expression, watching over his kids, you know, why is Antarctica at the top and the North Pole at the bottom? And they told me very matter-of-factly, there's no up or down in space. So having the way we normally do a map of the Earth is totally by convention, which I realized later on when I became an adult was of great philosophical significance. And so that's just what I wanted to bring up. But I almost, looking back on it, I almost feel like I made a spiritual round trip. Or it's either I made a spiritual round trip, or in a sense I never left, even though paradoxically I didn't officially become a member until 2001. It was my parents who left, and in a sense, it's kind of a paradox. It's like I always was you all along. I just didn't know it.
Just a couple of quick things. The freeway property, we were looking through the records the other day. We paid $3,000 for that. $1,500 an acre. It was 2 acres of property over there, close to the Mall of the Mainland, if you know that big wooded, just grassy area over there that's not developed right now. We used to not meet in the summertime, which I don't know whether many of you know that. So we would only meet during basically the school year. And the big party was on the last Sunday of the spring season. And we'd have this big picnic. And after the baker's house, moved out to Carbide Park, I think. We used to have it out there. And then during the summer, we'd have a few parties or something, but wouldn't start until the fall school season started again. And the funniest thing I remember about the Lamarck property was one Sunday we came in and there was obviously a rodent or something that had gotten into the building, and there was, you know, a few things a little torn up and things eaten. And so at the end of the service that Sunday, I think it was Neil and myself and one other member, we walked around the building and looked for, you know, where this thing might have gotten in, and we found a hole in the eaves by the back over by the RE building, and we plugged that hole up with some wire mesh and some steel wool and things like that so that it couldn't get back in. And then we came back next Sunday and found out it didn't need to get back in. It was already in when we blocked it in. And the next Sunday, the inside of the building was a horrendous mess. It had gone all around. We had carpet in the sanctuary, and it had gone all around the edges of the sanctuary room and dug through the carpet trying to find a way out. So don't ever close a rodent hole until you know where the rodent is.
Okay. Thank you all, and I'm sorry to cut it short, but stay for potluck and tell stories.